On the ground, we see a very different picture. We see continued resupply of weapons and fighters.
Окупанти неодноразово стріляли з гранатометів, причому як вдень, так і вночі.
We see continued provocations to keep the conflict going.
Бачать, що ми не відповідаємо, починають чуть більше стабільно обстрілюють нас. Дуже круто. Все одно не відповідаємо, вже починаємо, ми вже бачимо, що вони підходять ближче.
Rather than terminating this conflict, Russia's actions are having the effect of escalating it once again.
So the reports of the slow drip of death have been coming in daily. 3 killed and 3 wounded on one day, 3 killed and 16 wounded on another. 1 killed and 5 wounded on another, and 7 killed and 13 wounded on yet another. It becomes something of a blur. But when you add it all up, you need to go back nearly a year to find a month as deadly as July has been in the Donbas. Despite an alleged ceasefire, Ukraine's forgotten war appears to be escalating. So what's the cause, and what does it mean? Hello from our broadcast headquarters in Prague, and welcome to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFRL. Joining me on the Skype line from London is co-host Mark Galliotti, a senior policy fellow at the Czech Institute of International Relations in Prague, a visiting fellow at the European Council on Foreign Relations, and author of the blog In Moscow Shadows. Welcome, Mark.
Hey there, Brian.
So also joining us via Skype from the front lines in the Donbas in Bakhmut in Donetsk Oblast is RFRL's Ukraine correspondent Christopher Miller, who recently authored an extensive, in-depth, and I must say, excellent profile of Nadia Savchenko. Welcome back to the podcast, Chris. Great piece.
Thank you.
Thank you. And Chris, since you're on the front lines, why don't you get us started? You're in Bakhmut, as I mentioned. You spent a few days in Mariinka. Paint us a picture. What are you seeing there? Because we're reading the reports of this slow drip of death coming in. What's it look like on the ground?
Oh, similar to what you've been reading. What I see does not resemble a ceasefire at all, of course, right? We don't see, hear, or even feel, for that matter, anything resembling a ceasefire. Spending 3 days on the front line in Mariinka and 2 nights about 300, 400 meters away from separatist positions in Mariinka, you know, where the Donbas Ukraine battalion.
You're with Ukraine forces in Mariinka, obviously.
Yes, on the Ukraine side, yeah. So I spend most of my time with Donbas Ukraine. It came from the Donbas battalion in the beginning, since they've split apart and there's 2 different Donbas battalions now. But, you know, when I was with them for the last 3 days, they've been, they were trading heavy fire on an hourly basis, not even a daily basis. And nights, of course, are the worst. After, like you said, you know, several months of small arms fire, smaller skirmishes, both sides have returned to using the big guns on the front lines. You know, they're very careful about keeping those out of the sight of journalists and the OSCE, of course. As I think Andrew Kramer mentioned in a very good piece in the New York Times this week about the OSCE mission's inabilities to accurately track what's happening there. When I spoke with the Ukrainians and the Donbas commanders, you know, when I asked them about their artillery systems, you know, they didn't know what I was talking about, but then they would show me a video with footage of them exchanging artillery fire with separatists, right? And they're very close to each other. They're only about 100 meters apart at the narrowest point there in Mariinka. But, you know, like the sound and the fury of those artillery systems, and we're talking about tanks, Grad multiple launch rocket systems, those are unmistakable. So even if you don't see them, they're, you know, at this point, being out here for the last, you know, 2.5 years covering this, I know exactly what they sound like. And, you know, while they're hiding these things from plain sight, they're still being used. The first night that I was in Mariinka, the separatists fired tank rounds toward Ukrainian positions and missed, hit a house, which exploded, started a big fire. Thankfully, nobody was inside. But, you know, it shows that, you know, after months of relative calm, right, smaller skirmishes, we've returned to this, not all-out war yet. That's definitely a fear. But, you know, certainly a big escalation. The second night, last night, you know, it wasn't only tank fire and artillery, mortars and small arms, machine guns, but it was also Grad rockets. And you know, that was the first time in at least several days that those had been used from separatists, firing on Ukrainian positions. The Donbas Ukraine commander, Vyacheslav Vlasenko, who goes by the call sign OWL, was telling me that they're seeing more and more of Grads being used, other heavy artillery systems. He's a straight shooter. He doesn't think Minsk is going to work. You know, he just said Minsk is dead.
It's gone. Hardly controversial.
Hardly controversial. He was very pragmatic in the way that he said it. Like, you know, Minsk was a good effort, basically, is what he said. But it's dead. It's been dead for a long time. We need to find something else, whatever mm-hmm. it is, because he does fear that, you know, this escalation will continue.
And what you're seeing is separatists firing on the Ukrainian positions, and Ukraine is returning fire. I mean, does the instigator appear to be on the separatist side?
I mean, there's a pretty continuous firing going on, right? So who fired the first shot? I wasn't there for that. But as far as I know, they haven't stopped shooting since April 2014.
Now, you mentioned you've been there for more than 2 years. You were in there during the heat of the war, pre-Minsk. Obviously, right now, the front line's not moving like it is then. But how does it compare to that in terms of intensity?
We're not back to summer 2014 intensity. It's not at that level yet. You know, we saw some flashes in summer 2015. When there was actually a separatist push on Marinka. In May or June of last summer. I would say the fighting now is on par with that, more than August 2014 or the summer 2014, when it was volleys, nonstop volleys of artillery and heavy, heavy Grad shelling, you know, with towns completely leveled and destroyed. You know, we don't see that kind of destruction. There are quiet periods during the day. You know, for the most part, they keep to a pretty regular regime of starting the fire after dinner time and going through the night until about 3-4 in the morning. You know, and then they drink themselves to sleep or pass out, and then have breakfast, and then, you know, talk about where they're going to where they're going to fire the next day, and then start it over again after dinner.
Now, what you're saying kind of squares with a recent International Crisis Group report that went along the front lines on the Ukrainian side and said there's nothing here resembling a ceasefire at all. Mark, you suggested to me off mic that you think that the escalation we're seeing right now is driven less by Moscow and more by proxies kind of going rogue. What leads you to that conclusion?
One of the key things is, look, summer is campaign season. So in some ways, we can expect a regular uptick. And therefore, in a way, the best comparator is previous summer. This is just the cycle of the war. But that said, I mean, I think we have a mix. On the one hand, look, Moscow is clearly keen to keep up the pressure. You had the Ukrainian Prime Minister Groysman again coming out earlier this month, very much sort of pushing that there cannot be elections in the Donbass, which is obviously the sort of shorthand for any kind of political resolution, until Russian troops are out, which is clearly not the sequencing that Moscow is happy with. So you had Deputy Foreign Minister Karasin sort of saying, well, we think the Ukrainian government's ready for a big push and so forth. So there is that always that sense from Moscow that, you know, whenever they feel the Ukrainians might run the risk of forgetting, Moscow wants to remind them that this is actually a miserable conflict that they can continue to ratchet up. But if you actually look at a lot of the individual conflicts, the individual clashes, first of all, I mean, there's very clearly a lack of any kind of strategic plan beyond just the general mischief making. And also just in terms of the ordnance involved. I mean, Chris was talking about how sort of recently where he was, there was sort of a recent shift towards use of Grad rockets again. If you look at a lot of the detail of the clashes, particularly away from the sort of the key Avdiivka and so forth areas, a lot of it is actually mortars and such like rather than long-range artillery. In other words, the kind of organic firepower that the rebels have without actually needing for the Russians to provide them with artillery support or anything like that. And actually, this seems to be a sort of a smattering of raids. A, because there is a clear concern about Moscow forgetting them. They don't want to be traded off, and they need the conflict to continue. Secondly, there are also key mercenary objectives. If you fight, you get resupplied. If you get resupplied, you have stuff you can resell. Interestingly enough, of late we've actually seen, this is according to the Russian police, an uptick in smuggling of weapons both in and out of the Donbass. Now, this might sound perverse, but the point is you're smuggling weapons in because there are some units that are lacking, that basically the Russians aren't giving them what they feel they need. So they're actually having to basically buy it with their own criminal ill-gotten gains. But also smuggled out in the sense of units that are actually looking to capitalize on what they've got and basically make them monetize it and so forth. Which again, you know, it speaks to this fragmentation of effort. This is not something that is carefully controlled. And if anything, also, it looks as if it's the Donetsk proxies, including the Donetsk resident of the FSB, who seem at the moment to be most bullish. compared with Luhansk. So I think, you know, in a way, my reason is that actually what we see is, and this has been a consistent pattern, a fragmentation of effort. As I said, beyond just generally causing mischief, which is clearly a key Moscow strategic imperative, but beyond that, we actually see a striking lack of any real coherence to the efforts. And instead, we seem to be going back to not the, as it were, the open conflict between groups that we've seen in the past, but more of a sense of almost that actually, you know, in some cases, there are units that actually genuinely committed to their cause and want to make an advance. In some cases, there are units that actually use attacks as a way of forcing Moscow to provide them with more assistance. And that seems to be, as much as anything else, the dynamic at work.
Now, you mentioned earlier that Moscow likes to keep the pressure on, but does any of this, do you think, happening against the will of Moscow? Are the separatists going rogue, so to speak, in your opinion?
I don't think it's going rogue. I don't see any signs at the moment that Moscow is trying to rein things back, in part precisely because the political process has stalled. That's when we're likely to see the real tensions emerge. I mean, I said at the moment, if what you're looking for is generalized mayhem and mischief, then the guys in the Donbass are your guys. That's what they're good at. It's when you actually start to want some degree of finesse, some degree of control, and if, you know, and ideally some capacity to actually make deals on the ground. That's when you're really going to see the problems emerging. So I think it's at the moment, you know, there is nothing going on in the Donbass, shall we say, that Moscow is particularly unhappy with. But that doesn't mean to say that I think Moscow is necessarily currently strategically shaping the battlefield.
Mm. Chris, you're on the ground. Does this square with what you're seeing and hearing?
Yeah, definitely, mostly. I would maybe, I don't know. I wonder if there is an argument to be made that, you know, in recent weeks, because we've seen July was the deadliest month on record for a year, right? And
mid-July the deadliest month.
Yeah, sure. So, you know, but just being out there the last few days and seeing that heavy artillery is being used and more of it is being pulled back out. And if you read through the OSCE reports, you know, they go in and they monitor and, you know, count how many large artillery systems are being, you know, removed from storage on both sides of the line. You know, the numbers have been dwindling, you know,
right.
a lot of it has gone missing in recent weeks. And I wonder if that couldn't be, I mean, you know, using these systems, I would think that, you know, Moscow to some extent would have to sign off on, you know,
allowing
you know, the DNR to use grads, especially grads, you know, and tanks, right? And there were grads and tanks the last 2 days. I mean, if it continues like this, I mean, that would mark a pretty big escalation if more of these keep disappearing from storage and coming out and being used. I would, you know, the separatists have been reined in, you know, several times before, and suddenly Surkov will show up and scold them in Donetsk, you know, and then things will kind of quiet down and go back to, you know, relative, you know, ceasefire normalcy, you know, small skirmishes. But they haven't done that, and it's continued to kind of, you know, escalate for a period of, you know, 50 days. I saw this when I was speaking with Filin, the Donbass commander, and I asked him, you know, the first question I asked him was, so how are things? And he just shoved the paper across his desk, you know, with a giant situation map. And it was just a list of all of the casualties.
Uh-huh.
So it was like number of dead, number wounded, number of those soldiers who had, you know, underwent amputations, number of those shot or that took a hit from a bullet. And then there was like, you know, the numbers of those hit with shrapnel and other, you know, other things. And all of those numbers, he's seen all of these numbers increase over the last 50 days. I don't know. I would just, I wonder if you know, this isn't happening, at least to some extent, you know, even by not saying anything, you know, wouldn't that signal some kind of support from Moscow?
Yeah, I mean, I certainly wouldn't disagree with you there. I mean, I think actually we're not disagreeing. I think, again, it's a question of, is Moscow at the moment bothered enough to actually rein in what's going on? Absolutely not. I mean, I think there is certainly, at the moment, Moscow actually wants there to be more pressure. And I think, again, particularly because of the issue of the cycle of campaign season. Anyway, this is your good chance to ratchet up military pressure. Then you've got the winter to, you know, perhaps do the politicking. And that's when we tend to get the sort of the so-called Newland powwows and such like. You know, the,
right. Minsk was signed in February, after all.
If you look at the exact details of the weapons concerned, I mean, particularly the Grad multiple launch rocket system, that's a weapon that the rebels can and do use themselves. So in some ways, it's more a case of the Russians allowing them to get the Grads, passing them on a certain number of reloads, and then basically say, go on, boys, make some mayhem. We've seen less use of the big tube artillery systems, 122 and 152 millimeter stuff, which is definitely stuff that the Russians either actually are firing themselves or else are, you know, keeping it under much, much more control. So again, I mean, I think in some ways we can almost talk about, shall I say, three stages of the war. The war when it's just the rebels doing what they can with what they have in their organic artillery, which tends to be things like mortars and a few old tanks. Then there's the second stage, which is where we're at now, which is the Russians are kind of unlocking the keys and actually giving them a certain amount more of artillery and tanks, but basically still saying, oh, you know, go off, do your thing. Stage three, which we're not at the moment, and hopefully we won't, is actually when the Russians get involved, either because they fear that the Ukrainians are going to be making some kind of advance or because they want to really make a point themselves, when they not only do they actually provide the full panoply of weapons, but they also tend to surge in more of their own forces to actually carry the fighting.
Now, this is something I wanted to get at, because, again, Kristen, you and I were talking about this offline yesterday, about whether these you see reports every day almost from the Ukrainian authorities that there's X amount of Russian troops in Ukraine. What does the picture look like? And you seemed a bit skeptical of that. What does the Russian troop presence look like right now?
Yeah. I'm skeptical because I don't think that we've ever had a perfect picture of what this, you know, the scale of that is. I think NATO at some points, you know, over the last couple of years has, you know, inflated these numbers. I mean, I'm on the Ukrainian controlled side of the line right now, so I can't say, you know, what people are seeing or what is going on in Donetsk. But you know, I put the question to some of the Ukrainian commanders on the front lines. They said there's not anything to indicate right now to them that there's a massive influx of Russian soldiers. You know, they know as do all of the other foreign correspondents who have been here, like myself, that, you know, the people on the front line, which they call the meat, is you know, made up of the actual tractor drivers and miners who Putin says is really fighting this war. You know, but the second line is always, you know, the more highly skilled Russian volunteers and soldiers that are brought in, right? I mean, I think we are seeing, you know, as we've been talking about, a lot of artillery being used. But like Mark said, the separatists now, after 2 years, know how to use these things. And for the most part, it seems like they're firing rather inaccurately. I would think that if, you know, Russian soldiers are coming in here en masse, that, you know, given the high level of skill that we saw in Ilovaisk, in Debaltseve, that, you know, if as many of them were here as, you know, some people are saying, that we'd see a much more precise attack, you know, against Ukrainian positions. Mm-hmm. You know, but sure, there have always been, you know, hundreds, if not thousands, of Russian soldiers in Donbass. But they're very, very good at, you know, tucking themselves away and staying out of sight, mm-hmm. And, you know, or blending in. So, you know, it's really, really hard to know for sure. So, yeah, I mean, I'm skeptical because, you know, you just can't put your finger on a specific number.
Mark, would you share that skepticism?
Yeah, I mean, look, there are other people who no doubt have access to more sort of specific sources of intelligence. My best guess is, I mean, the sort of official estimates tend to range from 7,500 to 10,000 Russian troops. I think the bottom end of that, 7,500, actually sounds entirely plausible at the moment, with quite a few of them being electronic warfare specialists and other sort of non-teeth units. And then maybe there's, and again, this is even more impressionistic, perhaps 1,000 or so others, you know, FSB combat officers, special forces, that kind of thing. And that's just, as it were, people who are, whether uniformed or not, but shall we say, card-carrying members of the Russian military machine. And then there's, of course, all the various volunteers who may, you know, maybe volunteers under greater or lesser duress, that's much, much harder to estimate. Mm. So, I mean, the key thing is, I mean, if we're talking about between 7,000, 8,000, 9,000 troops, which is not that huge a commitment, the point is, though, that there's about 40,000 troops in the vicinity. And what we've seen in the past is it's not about how many troops are actually there in the Donbass that really matters. It's the Russians are very fast to surge their battalion tactical groups in whenever they feel the need to. And absolutely, as Chris has said, and at that point, you tend to see an absolute step change qualitatively. Right. And, you know, that's when you start getting the artillery is being vectored in by drones and satellite photography. And it's being, you know, basically the guns are being laid by people who have been well-trained and well-experienced.
Well, this is what we saw in the summer of 2014, right?
Precisely, and this is when you know you actually get really the cream of the Russian military being thrown in there, and you know, and with a very sort of clear effect. So again, I think at the moment what's clear is that you know, the combatants, some of them are very good, some of them are not so good, but they are clearly militia rather than properly controlled, fully disciplined modern soldiers.
Right. Now, one thing I wanted to get at, we've been kind of skirting around it throughout the program, is the degree to which the agendas of Moscow and the separatists coincide or diverge. And that's even assuming there's a single agenda on both sides, right? What do you think about that, Mark? How much do these agendas coincide and diverge, and are there two coherent agendas?
Well, I mean, I certainly don't think there is one rebel agenda. Even if one actually looked at the leaderships in Luhansk and Donetsk, I mean, the question is, how far do they genuinely control the various rebel forces at their disposal? Some efforts have been made, so often by bloody and kinetic means, to bring certain warlords to under control or just get them out of the way. But basically speaking, you know, we are still talking about very loose and thoroughly self-interested coalitions of people. Now, in terms of the agendas, I mean, at the moment, their agendas are relatively congruent. Moscow does not have a deal coming or, you know, even faintly sort of being offered by Kiev, although Moscow would love, I think, the deal that would allow it to pull out. Putin feels he needs, in my opinion, that kind of mission accomplished moment, and Kiev's not about to give him a triumph. So that, you know, at present, so long as Moscow's real kind of request of the rebels is keep making a mess, keep breaking things, and we'll keep providing you with the wherewithal to do that. And at the same time is willing to allow the blatant enrichment of many people within the rebel command on both petty and not so petty levels, then that's fine. You know, the rebels, who by definition are in some cases, you know, people motivated by genuine belief, but in other cases often motivated by the most selfish of self-interest, well, they're getting what they want. So now, fine, the question is, of course, that as soon as, if and when, there is some prospect of a deal, that's when suddenly I think we'll find the two agendas diverging dramatically. And also it's worth mentioning that a certain number of, as it were, Russian agents in the Donbass might well also find themselves under sort of more pressure. There are people who are, as it were, getting paid salaries from Moscow, but making their real money off embezzling and stealing and doing all kinds of deals. There are people for whom this is actually their big career opportunity, who may well want to keep the war going. We've seen this time and time again, that your local proconsuls actually become more of a problem than an asset often. So I think this is going to be something that unfortunately is going to become a real problem only when peace begins to become a possibility.
As it did in the early stages of Minsk, when it appeared to be somewhat implemented, right? I mean, we did see this kind of divergence early on after February 2015, no?
And we saw a few rebel commanders getting sort of gunned down or killed in mysterious incidences.
Chris, would you agree with Mark's assessment?
Yeah, absolutely. And I would add the very simple fact that a lot of the local separatist fighters on the front lines don't have jobs to go back to, right? Which would be another reason why there could be an escalation happening right now. They don't want the war to end. They don't, you know, the future is not very bright in a Donetsk People's Republic. You know, job opportunities are very, very limited. You know, they have a passport that allows them only access, I believe, to Russia. At least that's what they say. You know, as long as the war keeps going, like Mark said, they'll get paid, you know, basically to stand on the front lines and pull the trigger every once in a while. But, you know, if the war ends, either they're going to end up in prison, you know, if Kiev finds them guilty of, you know, what they're calling a terrorist act, right? There's this law on amnesty that everybody keeps talking about, but it hasn't been passed. And then that's only applicable to those who haven't committed a grievous crime, mm-hmm. right? You know, so keeping the war going keeps them paid, keeps them out of prison, and keeps, it's keeping them employed and alive, right? I mean, in a very strange way, I suppose. You know, there are very few job prospects and very little to do afterward. If Donbass is reincorporated into Ukraine, many of these guys are going to have to flee someplace, right? They don't have citizenship in Russia. They won't be able to get formal jobs, right? They'll have to be living off and working off the grid. You know, I think that's another reason why, you know, there's a flare-up every once in a while, too. You know, not only because, you know, Moscow wants to, you know, push buttons and, stir things up with Kiev, but also for this basic reason that a lot of these guys don't know what to do if they're not fighting.
Right. Now this sounds to me like a recipe for, even if there is peace, for them to be motivated to sabotage it, even if Moscow doesn't want that. Another thing I wanted to ask you about, Chris, is I know you're in Donbass now, but you're based in Kyiv. How is the war playing in Kyiv right now? Is it still on the front burner of everybody's attention, or is it kind of out of everybody? Because it's fallen off the world's attention. I called it the forgotten war in my intro. What's it like in Kyiv in that regard?
I mean, the feeling used to be palpable in Kyiv, right? At the height of the war in summer 2014, and then again when it flared in Debaltseve in February 2015, the tension was palpable in Kyiv. It was written across everybody's faces. You could see how it was wearing them down. But now, I think, you know, there's a very different feeling. It feels very disconnected from Donbass. Like the rest of the world, you know, their attention has moved away to other things. There's other other events happening in Kyiv that have taken their attention away, right? You had this religious procession that happened, you know, that's been going on for a couple of weeks that finally culminated in the Moscow Patriarchate marching in Kyiv. You know, that was a big topic and somewhat related to Donbass, but, you know, not war specifically. A lot of people are looking at what's happening in Europe, and then there's the refugee crisis, and there's, you know, the presidential elections, and Ukrainians this year are actually really interested in the presidential elections, I think because of the Trump-Putin connection. Mm-hmm. It definitely feels like there's a disconnect right now. People mm-hmm. are just not that interested. I think they're tired. You know, they're tired. It's been 2.5 years of killing and fighting, and they really do want peace, but nobody knows how to get it.
Is the sentiment that and it's been there among some in Kyiv, although it's highly controversial, whether or not this is a good idea or not is not what I'm interested. But is the sentiment growing that it'd be just best to just cut the Donbass loose, or cut the occupied areas of the Donbass loose, so to speak?
The sentiment is growing. It's grown some. It's not held by a majority. That's for sure. I would say, perhaps worryingly, that there is a growing sentiment that Ukraine should take the Donbass back by force. Mm-hmm. We've also seen people like Turchinov, the chief of the National Security mm-hmm. Defense Council, talking about imposing martial law, which is something that he hasn't spoken about since summer of 2014. And suddenly, with this escalation, he's brought the issue back up again, and they're currently discussing it in the National Security and Defense Council. You know, what that would entail, if it's going to be just something that's declared in Donbass.
Right, that was my question. Yeah, or all of Ukraine.
Yeah, sure. And he hasn't made that clear yet. But there is this kind of like talk of going to war again. You know, whereas like Ukraine's very much been on the kind of defensive, or at least, you know, the kind of this hold the line mentality for the last couple of years. You know, the last offensive Ukraine went on was in summer 2014, and mm-hmm. we know how that ended when the Russians, you know, came into Ilovaisk and basically wiped them out. You know, but there is this kind of growing sense of we should take the Donbass back, you know, by ourselves. And I think that's because they see that the West isn't going to provide any more assistance than they have already. Mm-hmm. And I think for whatever reason, there's a sense that people in Kyiv don't know if Putin is willing now to send in the troops at the same level that they did in 2014. Mm-hmm. To save the separatists then. So I don't know. That might be something that Mark could touch on.
Yeah, no, my guess is if it looked like Ukraine was going to take it back by force, those troops would come back in. Mark, what are your thoughts? on this?
Yeah, absolutely. I think there is a concern. I mean, there is a possibility for both sides to escalate in ways that really will be very dangerous. If Kiev honestly thinks that it's going to be able to take these forces, you know, take these areas back, despite the fact that the Russians do still have escalation dominance, they do have the capacity to match whatever Kiev can throw in their direction and raise. What's more, if they do that, I mean, not only are they going to find themselves with a lot of people coming home in body bags, but also, best case scenario is they reoccupy and then they have the job of pacifying an area that really then will have a lot of deep-seated grudges. And in a context in which they probably will have lost a lot of Western sympathy and support. In some ways, this actually feels terrifyingly like Georgia 2008, in which a country might well, in the name of trying to reestablish sovereignty, actually give the Russians every excuse to do whatever they want. At the same time, though, I mean, I think, you know, we tend to assume that Russia is happy just sitting back with this drip, drip, drip of casualties and so forth. On a human level, they might at some point decide, no, there's a need to actually up the stakes. And precisely because of this move that Chris was talking about, of actually people in the rest of Ukraine essentially getting, well, I wouldn't say inured to what's going on in the Donbass, but used to it. In a very, very perverse way, and obviously I don't for a minute want to draw too close a comparison, I'm always thinking of the British and Northern Ireland, different conflicts and so forth. But after a certain point, you get used to the fact that part of your country is a bit of a war zone because it's over there. Now, to really bring the issue back onto the center of the political agenda, the IRA in due course turned to a bombing campaign on the British mainland. Basically to say this war is not just on the other side of a sea. It's not just fought by the people in Northern Ireland and the army and the Royal Ulster Constabulary. And one wonders if at some point Moscow will feel the temptation to once again, as it has in the past, turn to sabotage and terrorism in the rest of Ukraine, precisely just as a way of kind of nudging Kiev and saying, don't think that this can go on forever. Don't think that you can continue to use it as how Moscow thinks of it, your alibi with the West for not actually reforming properly. We can actually make this uncomfortable. Mm. Either would be a deeply dangerous and frankly pretty stupid move, but unfortunately we've seen deeply dangerous and stupid moves in the past.
Throughout this entire war. Chris, you wanted to jump in, I saw.
Yeah, I was just going to say on that note, you know, I mean, one of the leading theories in the murder of the investigative journalist Pavel Sheremet last week is that, you know, Russia did this, right? That's what, you know, I think National Security Council is saying. What the president is even saying is that there's a Russian trace. You know, one possibility is that, yes, the war is happening in Donbass and people are forgetting that it's happening all around the country. It's not, you know, out of the realms of possibility that somebody who wants the rest of the country to remember that there is a war going on to bomb somebody in central Kiev in order to kind of like bring that painfully.
And we've seen bombings in Odessa and elsewhere.
Sure. Yeah. Kharkiv as well.
Kharkiv. Yeah. So it's not like it's something that hasn't happened before. Before we move on to the last section, I wanted to touch on something, Chris, you noted at the very outset, and I made a note to close on this. Your commander said, you know, Minsk is dead, Minsk is over, we need something else. Where does this go? Where do people see this going politically now? If Minsk is dead, what do we have? Are people talking about a Minsk 3, God help us?
Nobody wants a Minsk 3, but nobody knows what comes next or what there should be. I think there's general consensus on the front line that nobody knows exactly what to do. Filin said very boldly that I will see this war as being over when my troops march on Red Square.
Uh-huh. Which means we have war without end. Mark, what are your thoughts on this?
Minsk has been dead for a long, long time.
Yes.
In part, the problem is that basically, given the West were, as it were, the midwives to birthing Minsk II, they don't really want to admit that what a stupid decision it was in the first place. I think this is it. At the moment, it's a classic thing. You only actually have serious negotiations if you really think you can achieve something with them. I don't think at the moment any of the parties concerned know what they can honestly get from any kind of negotiation. So everyone would like to think that there was going to be some option for not Minsk 3, but some kind of a deal. No one knows what it can be. And that also implies, frankly, in Moscow. And in that context, of course, there's not going to be any discussion. Any discussions would just simply be exploratory. They would be raising prospects and hopes that are going to be doomed. And finally, Moscow doesn't want to start the process because then Moscow looks as if, in effect, it's suing for peace. Kiev doesn't want to start the process for exactly the same reason. And the West really does not want to get back involved into that particular snake pit.
Right. And the West is pretty distracted. And at the heart of all of this, I mean, we have to remember this isn't about Donbass. This is about Ukraine. What Moscow wants isn't Donbass. What Moscow wants is a veto over Ukraine's future political direction. And it's not going to agree to anything that doesn't give it that. And Kyiv knows that that's what Moscow wants, and it isn't going to agree with anything that gives Moscow that. So really, I mean, I don't see any way out of this in any way, shape, or form. We're not going to get a frozen conflict like myself and many others were predicting about a year ago. We're getting an endless simmering conflict that's just going to keep going on and on and on like this, I fear. I don't know any last thoughts on that before we switch topics.
It's an upbeat prospect, obviously.
I used to be the optimist in this podcast, but no, those days are long gone.
We all get old. But the issue is, Moscow has actually more flexibility, theoretically. I mean, this is a war of choice for Moscow. It is an existential struggle for Kiev. If at a certain future point, I mean, obviously, if a different leadership, all bets are off. But even under a Putin leadership, if they decide that, in fact, the costs are not worth it, they could engineer a withdrawal. The point is at the moment that for Moscow, the military, political, and economic costs compared with the prospective benefits of pulling out are not good enough. The deal is nowhere near good enough from their point of view. But theoretically, that could happen in a way that, as I said, I cannot see how Kiev could compromise without basically just handing over its sovereignty in a bowl.
So it's a prescription for a war to continue for a long time, although at a low intensity level. Well, in a few moments, we'll continue our discussion, shift gears, and take a look at that other story that was in the news this week. I'd like to remind you, you are listening to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFRL. Joining me on the Skype line from London is co-host Mark Galliotti, a senior policy fellow at the Czech Institute of International Relations in Prague, and a visiting fellow at the European Council on Foreign Relations and author of the blog In Moscow Shadows. Also joining us via Skype from the front lines in Donbass in Bakhmut in Donetsk Oblast is RFRL's Ukraine correspondent Christopher Miller. I'd also like to remind you could subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes. You can read the Power Vertical blog and watch the Daily Vertical at RFRL.org, and you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical.
The Russian card is firmly featured in the red corner on the desk of all Washington's politicians during the election campaign. Moscow is at pains to avoid any actions or words that could be interpreted as a direct or indirect meddling in the American electoral process. As to all these scarecrows about Russia, it resembles a group of partygoers who keep spooking one another with scary stories to end up being collectively afraid.
Well, that, of course, was Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov denying any Russian role in the hacking of the Democratic National Committee's email server. A consensus, however, is solidifying among cyber sleuths and intelligence officials that Russia was indeed behind the hack. And suspicion and speculation is rampant that Vladimir Putin may be attempting to influence the U.S. presidential elections. And if this is the case, it would be very disturbing, and it would be disturbing regardless of which side Russia was attempting to intervene for. And if this is indeed the case, it would certainly fit a pattern from former Soviet states like Ukraine, Moldova, and Georgia to EU members like Germany and France. Russia has been actively intervening both covertly and overtly in Western countries' internal affairs for years. But Mark, as you noted in an excellent piece in Foreign Policy this week, there is another pattern as well. When intervening in other states' domestic affairs, Putin's Kremlin has a track record of getting things spectacularly wrong. I believe you called him a bumbling meddler. I don't want to talk so much about the minutiae of the U.S. case, but let's talk about this general trend of how Russia's tendency to try to intervene in other countries' affairs. The infamous Lisa case in Germany, of course, comes to mind. But having these things backfire, Mark, spell out your argument for us.
Yeah, I think we've seen that Putin is much, much better at creating chaos than he is about directing and harnessing it to specific ends. And I think in part this reflects an absolutely fundamental misunderstanding of democratic politics. I think, to be honest, Putin and those who are of like mind in the Kremlin essentially hold three interconnected beliefs about democratic societies that are fundamentally wrong and always lead to these misunderstandings. First of all, they believe that ultimately elites, handfuls of people, actually run everything. In some ways, they tend to assume that the Western democracies really are just like the Kremlin's quote-unquote democracy, but just better at it. They have just found more effective tools of managing the process so that you have the veneer of elections and participation, but in fact, it's a, you know, if you can identify the handful of people who make the decisions and get at them and their interests, then the rest will follow. Second thing is, obviously, their view is that everyone is basically either an honest cynic or a hypocritical one. That's the only real question. No one actually believes anything they say. You know, values, this is all nonsense. Values is just soft power. Actually, it's, you know, it's about specific interests. So again, can you actually come up with the right deal? I hesitate to call this the art of the deal, but this is very much about precisely, can you actually get the right form or whatever that is going to kind of win these people over to you? And the third element of this is basically, again, a belief that the masses are controllable. That with the right mix of propaganda and suasion and lie and fear, you can get them to do whatever you want. As I said, I mean, I think these are all deeply questionable, and these are all basically about mirror imaging, not realizing, for example, that not only are Western masses exposed to a much, much more complex and varied information sphere, even if they choose to actually only follow one particular line, all the way through to actually that the elites do not control everything what's going on. I mean, let's be perfectly honest. If elites control things, Britain would not be leaving the European Union. I mean, I think, you know, we have seen some very good examples of actually the extent to which the masses have their own voice. But because of this misunderstanding, I think time and again, we have seen this sense that actually you can just sort of target particular interests. For example, you know, whether it's the sort of military threats against the Swedes and the Finns to try and get them to not get closer to NATO, which actually has pushed them all the closer to NATO. Or whether it's leaning on the Baltic states or encouraging particularly sort of divisive movements or kidnapping a security officer across Estonia's border or whatever. All meant to basically make the Estonians and the other Balts fearful and thus inclined towards appeasement. And what has it done? Exactly the opposite. It's very much sort of hardened their view that Russia is a threat and got them more and more concerned about wanting to get support. And the final example, and there are many, I mean, we could just continue to go listing them, but the one you raised, the Lisa case, this case when it's sort of completely sort of false story about migrants raping this Russian-German girl. Now, probably the Kremlin didn't actually create it, but on the other hand, they jumped on it so enthusiastically.
At a very high level.
Absolutely. I mean, and they obviously thought, they thought this was going to be their key with Chancellor Merkel, that this would actually get her sort of, you know, shifting views on migration and so forth. And actually what they did is infuriate her and also provide a particular kind of a poster child case for Russian attempts at disinformation. Now, so this does not mean that none of this matters, because the Russians, as I said, are good at stirring up divisiveness and trouble and creating chaos and disunity and pitting different communities against each other. Sadly, they're good at that. But the flip side of that is they're very bad at then actually successfully predicting the outcomes and guiding it in directions that really suit them.
Mm. And it's not just in the West that they're doing this. About a year or so ago, I wrote a piece called What Putin Got Wrong in Ukraine. And to me, it's pretty mind blowing that he could get these things wrong about Ukraine, because they're patently obvious to anybody who spent any time in Ukraine. I mean, the first thing he got wrong is that he thought he could buy Ukraine by buying the elites, the famous loan to Yanukovych. We all know how that worked out. He thought he could use the same repressive methods on Ukraine, cracking down, encouraging and in many ways coercing Yanukovych to crack down on the Maidan protesters a la Bolotnaya. Well, we know how that worked out. And then the big enchilada was this, you know, belief that Ukraine's Russian speakers we're going to automatically be pro-Moscow as a result of their first language and or ethnicity. And again, we all know how that worked out. Anybody that spent any time in Odessa or Kharkiv or Dnipropetrovsk could tell you that. In addition to all that, I added to this piece, they also got Germany wrong, segueing back to the Liza case. But it still blows my mind how Putin did not understand that the first territorial annexation of somebody else's territory since the Second World War wasn't going to freak the Germans out as it did. So this is something we see both in the West and closer to home for Russia in the former Soviet space. Chris, you've been in Ukraine for a long time. What have you seen there along these lines of things they've gotten wrong there and elsewhere in the former Soviet Union?
Well, since I'm here in Donbass, I mean, I think we can point to, you know, the conflicts here in Donbass. I mean, you know, I think Putin miscalculated hugely here, thinking that people in Donbass, Russian speakers, ethnic Russians, would go the way of Crimea and want to be annexed and want to be brought into the fold. And, you know, while there are certainly a lot of people here who would like to be a part of Russia, they either don't make up the majority or there was enough resistance in, you know, spring 2014 that it caused this conflict to start. That's, you know, his miscalculation here certainly is a big one. Also, you touched on, you know, some of the incidents in Germany where he miscalculated. That's certainly been very interesting to watch because he worked so hard, Putin, that is, to build relations with Germany and then totally miscalculated the reaction of the Germans after the annexation of Crimea, but also the war in Donbass, right? We haven't seen the EU hit Russia as hard as the Ukrainians would like with sanctions, but it's been Germany that's made sure that the EU, you know, stays united in keeping sanctions on Moscow.
Now, one other thing I wanted to, along these lines, is, and Mark, you touched on it. I mean, they're very good at stirring chaos. And a lot of people think, at least in the West, that's all they want to do. They're not trying to influence the U.S. election. They're not really trying to get Marine Le Pen elected in France. They're just trying to just stir up tensions, create division, undermine Western confidence in institutions. Would you agree with that? Or are there real concrete goals behind these interventions?
I mean, again, thinking of these three points you have in Ukraine, again, a sense that the elite are all cynics. And therefore thinking that basically they could buy the oligarchs through a mix of sort of offering deals and threatening assets. Secondly, that the elites can then control the country. We know that if Poroshenko turned around tomorrow and said, actually, we're going to make a deal with Russia, they're going to pull out of the Donbass, but we're going to say we're not going to sort of get closer to the European Union or whatever, Poroshenko would be history. And thirdly, this business of the masses having their own mind, which applies absolutely, as Chris said, to the Russian speakers, but also to ordinary Ukrainians, you know, who demonstrated that they're willing to put up with economic hardship and a whole variety of other pressures in order to not buckle down and not surrender the ambitions and the expectations and the hopes of the Maidan. So it definitely, as you said, it applies wherever. But in terms of the sort of the wider strategy, look, the Russians are multifaceted and complex in their aims. Often they have specific things they would like to see ideally. Certain leaders that they would rather see in office and certain leaders they would rather not. That's absolutely true. But the point is, the big picture is not, I think, for a minute that Moscow thinks that it's going to be able to control Europe or the West or really have any major traction on it. I think absolutely the key objective is to neutralize the West. The West is an obstacle to what Russia really wants. And what Russia really wants is to basically have its sphere of influence, which obviously includes Ukraine, and the capacity to basically treat the global system as a buffet from which they get to pick the nice bits they fancy nibbling and ignore the rest. Globalized financial systems, we'll have that, thank you. International law, no, it's all right, we'll pass. And basically, if the West is sufficiently divided, distracted, and so forth, then it is not in a position to prevent Russia from doing that. So I think that is absolutely the core leitmotif. Some things will help, some things will hinder. You mentioned Le Pen. Of course, the Russians have all kinds of reasons why they would like to see Le Pen win in France. But I don't think in the long run they actually think that a Le Pen-run France would actually be that much more of an asset. It's more that in the short term, that will be thoroughly destructive for the European Union. Mm-hmm. So I think this is it. It's actually disruption rather than reshaping.
Yeah, no, I think you've tied together all of these cases very well here, from the DNC hack to the Lisa case to the Ukraine conflict. We're basically seeing what unifies all of this. Something you said earlier as well, Mark, kind of to sum it all up, I wrote this down. Moscow doesn't believe civil society exists. This is their most fundamental miscalculation of the West. They think civil society is some kind of a fiction that somebody just dreamed up, that societies can have their own agency, independent of some elite's political agenda. This is what they misunderstood about the Maidan. And this is also what they seem to continuously misunderstand about the West. On that note, we will wrap it up. That's all we have time for today. I'd like to remind you, you have been listening to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFRL. Joining me on the Skype line from London has been co-host Mark Galliotti, a senior policy fellow at the Czech Institute of International Relations in Prague, a visiting fellow at the European Council on Foreign Relations, and author of the blog In Moscow Shadows. Also joining us via Skype from the front lines in the Donbass, in Bakhmut and Donetsk Oblast, has been RFRL's Ukraine correspondent Christopher Miller. Thank you both for an enlightening and interesting discussion.
Thank you.
And I'd also like to thank our producers, Pavel Balak and Andreas Kunchina, for ably filling in for the vacationing Tanya Kancheva, proving that it takes two to replace Tanya. I'd also like to thank my indispensable colleague, Pavel Butorin, managing editor of RFRL's Russian language television program, Current Time, which you can watch at www.currenttime.tv. I'd also like to remind you, you could subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes. You could read the Power Vertical blog and watch the Daily Vertical at RFRL.org. And you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical. Join us again next week. And now, as always, I leave you with the ambient sounds of my favorite socially conscious Russian rapper, Noise MC.